In January of 1972, when I was a teenager, there was a television show that debuted called Emergency. It was a show that we were allowed to watch, being church kids. It was actually a safe storyline, and it was fairly wholesome. And as Wikipedia puts it, the show combined medical drama with action adventure. So this was a show set in California. It was a fire station when the term paramedic first was introduced to the nation. So the paramedic term comes from a healthcare worker being able to provide clinical care to a patient under a doctor's supervision. So the way it worked was they had this new technical equipment that actually wirelessly talked to the hospital, and the doctor was in the hospital doing his rounds and other thing, and the guys would be out in the field somewhere at the car wreck or the burning building or whatever, and they would open their equipment and their boxes and get their EKG reading and give the blood pressure and back to doctor, whatever his name was, and then they would transport and do some D5W and whatever it was, and it was a great little storyline. And like I said, it was action adventure. John and Roy, Squad 51, they always had something to fuss about, and it was either a girl or the cooking or some corny thing, but there was always something to carry the storyline along as they wove their action-adventure into the story. But I tell you, when Squad 51 fire alarm went off, everything stopped. The cooking stopped, the fussing stopped, and everybody threw on their boots and helmets, and they got in those trucks, and they took off down the street, and they were headed to the emergency, whatever that was. And they were the first responders, and they were there to take care of the needs. It's kind of cool to be around firemen. I haven't been around them all that much, but anybody that wears a uniform as good looking as they have, that's pressed and starched, however they do that. But it's just kind of cool to be around on big fancy red trucks or yellow or whatever color they might happen to be. But these guys just emanate power and knowledge and safety, and they're just a pleasure to be around. And they're real people too. So as a background for this message, I went and looked at several occupations that we think of as kind of the professional, the uniform, the doctor, the lawyer, the whoever it might be. There are many occupations that take a lot of training, and I started out talking about the firemen. Firemen definitely take a lot of training. They go through months of on the job, of classroom work, of fighting fire techniques, of learning life-saving skills. Doctors might have 11 to 15 years of education and residency and extensive testing. You don't want just anybody working on you and poking and prodding around on your body. You want somebody working on you that knows what they're doing, and when they give you a diagnosis, you want to know that it's accurate and right. Policemen are in the same, boat. I guess that would be a Navy thing, but policemen are in the same category of requiring a lot of training, of classroom training, of field training, many different situations that they get involved in that require a high degree of training and expertise. Even what would sound like a simple job, just how about a historian, just somebody who wants to study history and or maybe teach history. Well, even a historian would have to get a bachelor's degree to do the most menial historical task, but then they would probably go on and get a master's degree or a PhD, and he would have to be very educated in the field that he is proposing to be an expert on. So none of these are easy. They take commitment and fortitude, commitment being the dedicated to a cause or an activity, and fortitude being mental strength and courage to endure in pain or adversity. It takes a lot of grit to not only get through the training, but then to perform some of these jobs, either it's long hours or difficult circumstances or dangerous, whatever it may be, it just takes a lot of grit to get through it. So if you want to be something, if you want to be somebody, you're probably going to have to study and work and train and practice and work and rebuild and keep changing your ways and keep making modifications as more maybe education, more research is done. You're going to find that there are things you're going to have to continually update. And they don't just hand out doctor's degrees or lawyer degrees or whatever it might be, unless you're a scam university, and then they do it for money, and that's a whole different subject. But all of these different trades that I've spoken of take a lot of time and training, and we want them to be trained. We want them to be skilled if they're going to advise us or work on us or protect us. There are also a lot of misconceptions about some of the first responders. And for instance, one of them surprised me was on average, a policeman will work his entire career and never pull his handgun and use it to protect himself in the line of duty. He will go through dozens and hundreds and probably thousands and thousands of rounds of ammunition on the shooting range, but it's actually uncommon for a policeman to pull his weapon in the line of duty. And when they do, that's carefully studied and tracked as well. But they have ongoing repeated exercises, and they are ready when the call comes and they have to put it into action. Firemen do not fight fires every day. They spend a lot of time going to senior citizen homes and checking on elderly patients, or maybe dealing with car accidents of one kind or another, or I could suspect somebody spends a lot of time polishing their trucks because the chrome is always so nice in the parades, and it's they have a lot of downtime, but they're always ready no matter what the situation is. They have to be ready. It's a similar situation for us, you know. We have training sessions on a yearly basis, and we have it on a seasonal basis and a weekly basis, being here at Sabbath Services, and on a daily basis, we're in God's Word, and we're teaching it to our children or to somebody, or we're reading it for our own good. We're trying to learn what we can out of God's Word, and we're constantly training and trying to bring our skills up because someday we might need them. Many of us lead fairly simple lives. There's not too much excitement, kind of like the firemen, you know, the guys sitting around in Squad 51 arguing with each other. They have time on their hands, and life is good, you know, like the T-shirt says, life is good. For others, life is more complicated. They may have health issues or financial issues or issues of various kinds. Many of us lead a fairly simple, stable life. In good times, life goes along. We're kind of like the light on the hill, right? You know, we're not out there waving our flag. We're just the light on the hill. People can see us, and we are disciples of Christ, and we are learning to love one another, and we're practicing the golden rule, and it all is going along great. And sometimes you wonder, with all this training, what are we going to do with all that? It's like we just get trained and trained and trained, and how does it get expressed? What happens with all that training? What happens? It's like, you know, some people have been in the church decades and decades, and it seems like life is just kind of goes along most of the time. So, yeah, Squad 51 had their petty little arguments. Sometimes in the church we fuss amongst ourselves, and we try to work it out at the end of the day, and we try to move on and create peace and do the right thing and try to apply what we've been given. Similar to the firefighters, we don't typically go from one scene, one emergency scene to another in our daily lives. We're not just in crisis every day. Most people aren't, but some have a little more of that due to health and other reasons. Much of our lives are spent low-key. We're very, very blessed in this country. And then something happens, and the fire alarm goes off, and we have to stop what we're doing, and we get called into action. And you never know when that call is going to come. That was the case for our family a couple months ago. No one sends you a postcard, and no one's going to tell you that something bad is going to happen today. It's just another day, and then the call comes. And it's a shock to everyone. And the woulda, coulda, shoulda, the incomplete plans and the projects that aren't done and the intentions that are unfulfilled are suddenly over and done and it's final. So we have people on camera that don't know my brother got killed a couple of months ago. And I'm going to work through this, and it's going to be all right. There's no doubt in my mind that God could have stopped it. And why he didn't is up to his perfect wisdom and his will. He allowed it. But it's our job to carry on, to do the right thing, and to use the situations that he presents us with, to use them for his glory, and to see even if God doesn't express or if we can't see God's hand in the situation, can we see God's hand in the aftermath? Can we see what God is doing in our lives or in someone else's lives? What can we see? Can we trust that God knows what he's doing? And can we use that circumstance and that? Can he use that circumstance for good? Can he use it to glorify himself? Can we see anything positive when God allows tragedy? That's what I want to focus on, not the woulda, coulda, shoulda. So the proverbial fire alarm went off in our family. It actually went off in the church and in his community. It's interesting that in Oklahoma, they have tornadoes. They live in Tornado Alley, and these sirens, people are very familiar with sirens in Oklahoma. And his alarm was heard loud and clear. But there were blessings that God left us with, that God allowed, that would be so easy to overlook at first. And I, right from the beginning, started trying to keep track of them because they were just amazing to me. So God didn't leave him in a recovery situation. You know, many of us would not do well in recovery. There are financial and there are many reasons that recovery is not fun. There's rehabilitation and convalescence and regeneration and recovery, financial, emotional, bills skyrocket. Everyone's life is thrown into disruption with hospital visits and infections and incomplete surgeries and maybe paralysis or limited function and unable to work. And death is just permanent. God says, here's your answer. And you have to say, God, I accept that. We have to accept it. And in the end, maybe it is a blessing in disguise that we have to deal with and think about. So immediately after the accident, elders from Oklahoma City came out to be with his wife and daughter. That's about 85 miles-ish, depending on where they were coming from. And that night, the wife and the daughter went back to the elder's home and stayed there. And then the next day they came to the airport to pick up mom and me, and we went back to their home in Watonga, Oklahoma. So word had already gotten around the community that my brother was gone. The siren had gone off. When we arrived at the house, someone had mowed the grass and done the weed eating. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. Shortly after that, supper arrived. I didn't know who it was, but it was a member of the community wasn't at the church. Next day, more food arrived, and the food kept coming to the point we didn't really know what to do with it all. And when the flowers were there, there wasn't room for the flowers either. These were not offerings of the church. These were offerings of the people, of the community that whose lives they had touched. We live in a country that is slipping or free-falling, depending on how you look at it, away from godly values. And it was so nice to go into a part of rural America where God was still respected, the human compassion and sympathy and hard work are still respected, and the community stepped up and did amazing things, and it was very impressive. There are a lot of people in this country that make a lot of noise, and usually it's the vocal minority. But there are some decent, hardworking people that don't mind living by godly Christian values, and one of them is loving your fellow man. The community responded bigger than I ever would have imagined by their outpouring of love. No hostility, there was mourning and disbelief, and what are we going to do now? But it went beyond that. Gerald had lived in that town for many years, and his offerings and accomplishments were widely known. And he'd worked for a lot of those people, and they knew his abilities and his care and his concern. And he had been a light to them, and that light had far outshone any of his negative characteristics, which is really a good thing for any of us, that what we do right far outweighs what we do wrong. But it was interesting because he was a self-employed businessman and he had his fingers in a lot of things. It was interesting to walk into someone else's life because you really never know what you're going to find. So again, he had a lot of loose ends. He worked for a lot of people, had a lot of different kinds of equipment. He had equipment spread all over the country, it seemed like. And part of my job in being there was to help collect this equipment and figure out, you know, like get all this stuff back home so that it could all be in one place and not be bothering other people. So I would go and meet with either the customer or a business person, whoever it would be, and it was just interesting to hear the comments. And they could have been, you're walking into someone else's life. You don't know exactly what you're going to hear. So from one customer, he said, "I never looked at his bills. I sent them straight to the check writer. If I had to look at his bills, I didn't think I could trust him." And in other words, he trusted my brother, and there was no reason to waste his time micromanaging. If Jerry said it was X number of dollars, then that's what it was, and there was no doubt about it. We found out that he had a very good name and that he could be trusted, and there's a whole sermon there. But one man commented that, you know, I just thought my brother could have come up with a more creative term or name for his business. His name of the business was GLI, for Gerald Leon Imes, GLI Works. And the guy said, "You know what? It was really true." I thought, you know, I never thought about it that way before. I always thought it was just a corny name for a business, and yet his business name told what he did and what he was. I talked to the insurance agent to go over the policy, and the agent had not heard about it, and he was stunned. He said, the insurance agent said, "I just lost a good friend." I thought, like, wow, you know, I suppose somebody should say that about my insurance agent, but... So I talked to the banker. I said, we're dealing with bank issues. He said, "I really appreciated talking to Gerald. He was straight up and had insight. They talked through many money deals, and Jerry was straight. He wasn't trying to hide anything or cheat on his business. He was just straight up. Many of the business people groaned about how they were going to get their equipment fixed now because Jerry used to get a big service truck with a crane and every tool you could imagine, and he would go out in the middle of the wheat field and fix people's equipment and save them tons of time and energy, because otherwise, and now, they're going to have to load up that broken piece of equipment, haul it to Oklahoma City or somewhere else, and it's going to cost them a lot of money to do what he would do as a part of his daily routine, and he charged them fairly, and it was widely known. He was also like many people that had more to do than he could ever get done, and I'm sure he knew it. He would always go work for someone else before he would, you know, mow his own grass, let's say, or fix his own fence, but he was always, you know, he's trying to keep food on the table. And after living that way for a number of years, you're just upside down and you'll never catch up. And that's the way that's what was left when he departed. And so to take a giant leap forward in tidying up his property, a work party was scheduled for Sunday, Father's Day. And so in the 100-degree heat with 100% humidity, there were about 25 people showed up to help clean the place up. And that's what happens when you're too busy to keep your own place cleaned up, then other people have to come help you. But it was interesting how the community responded for that. One fellow happened to be a customer. He gave us, loaned us his skid steer with forks and grapple and all this different stuff, forks. And so we were able to easily move big, heavy stuff around and to get it into place and dump it and whatever needed to be done. The guy did not have to do that. No one has to lend something, but he did, and he was happy to do it. We had arranged for a large dumpster to be delivered prior to the work party, and we filled it, and on Monday morning after it was over, I called the dumpster people, and I said, hey, I want to make sure the payment's in place for this thing, and he said, hey, there's not going to be any charge for that. $500. One of Gerald's customers brought two of his hired hands to the work party, so the customer came to the work party, and he brought his own employees, and they worked all day sorting things out and helping to identify different things that we have no idea what they were. He was able to contribute in that way and help them. Others at the work party worked in the garden. They dug the potatoes, pulled the weeds, picked the zucchinis, also rebuilt fence, did other things that needed to be done. Other customers were making effort to get the equipment that was out at their place at their own expense. They were moving it back into his place to get it all back in the same place for her to be able to deal with. At least a couple of the customers wrote checks based on what they thought the bills were going to be. No invoices. They just said, well, you know, he was there about X number of hours, and they just wrote the check. And someone anonymously paid the funeral bill. Just how does that work? I've never heard of things like this. The memorial service was, the facility was donated, and so we had a memorial service, and the luncheon there was donated. Who does that in the big city, and anybody that's looking at the bottom line? One of his customers has offered to let us, whatever equipment that needs sold, we can sell it. He has frontage property on a highway, and he said, well, you can just park that stuff out there and sell it, you know, no charge. Two different people offered to come by and help load some of the scrap metal out and haul it to the dump. The business across the road offered to store his service truck, which is, again, a big thing with the crane on it and all the tools, very expensive to replace. They said, you know, why don't you bring that over here and park it inside of our building, and we'll help you do that. So they actually did it for her and moved this truck inside out of the weather and out of sight. Unbelievable. His wife works for a motel in town. The owner of the motel owns all three motels in town, and she knew that family was coming, and she did a no charge for all of us for at least one night, and then reduced rates for additional nights. There were at least seven rooms that we were using, so that was amazing. So when they as she starts to downsize, she changed her phone plan, and they reimbursed her a couple thousand dollars because of whatever plan they were on. How does that work? So they had non-refundable deposits on their feast housing that they refunded for her. A college fund was set up for my niece, which is accumulating at an incredible rate. It's just very heartwarming to see how that's adding up. And you know, tragedy is hard to cope with, but it has a way of pulling people together. The local community came together, the church comes together, and family comes together. You know, in general, we would never get together as a family. We haven't been together as a family probably since the last funeral. And that's a sad state, but it's just hard for people to make the time and spend the money and to say, we're going to do it. It's the fire bell going off that allows you to make the sacrifice and get it done. So at church, the audio guy wasn't there. I may have gone into this a while back, and no one was familiar with the equipment. It all belonged to my brother. And so I was scrambling trying to put it together, and the pastor and his sons were working on it, and it was nobody saying, it's not my job, like, good luck with that or anything. Everybody was pulling 100%. Paul Moody, June 25th, gave a sermon. He talked about laboring in the Word and therefore living the Word. And I think about what my brother was doing, apparently he was doing a lot of things right in his world, and the people that he was dealing with and his circle, that people were impressed by his ethics, his loyalty, his way of life, and he was often questioned. He often had we had conversations that people had stopped him, or they wanted to know, you know, we would say, well, the hope that lies within you, and he would have to explain something. And so one of the recent events was that he was under the hood of this dozer, you know, covered in grease and tools flying and everything, and the owner came out to check up on him and wanted to know whatever the Bible question was. I can't remember what that was, but Jerry's pulling pistons or whatever and having to explain, you know, God's word out in the heat of the day under the hood. So it just didn't bother him a bit to do that, and I think what a great example. Joyce was commenting, she flew back from Minneapolis this week, and as they were flying, the pilot came on and said that there was some bad weather ahead, and so they're in the plane flying at 30,000 feet or whatever it is, and the clouds are down below them, and there's a lightning storm down below the clouds. And so she's riding along in this airplane in relative safety, and they're watching this fireworks going on down below. And that's kind of the way it feels in the church sometimes when we understand God's word and our hope in the future, and we can look at the storms that go on around that are going on, that we have an understanding that is far above those storms. Those people, they're worried about daily life. They're worried about what's going to happen and who done what to whom, and it's just interesting it's just a blessing to be in a position where you understand what we understand, that we understand what death is, and we understand the resurrection and God's plan. It's a wonderful thing to be there, and we trust that God is going to see us through. So I started out talking about training that different occupations are required to have. It's not our occupation that I'm hinting at here, and you know that. But where a person might aspire to be a doctor or a lawyer or a fireman, I thought my alarm clock was turned off. I guess not. We are aspiring to become God's children, and we're in an embryo stage where we have the ways and means to be a functional part of God's family now, and that means that God's ways are in the forefront of our minds, and that we conduct our lives in a way that demonstrates that we're serious about our mission. We try very hard not to be hypocritical. We try to live God's way and to demonstrate that we're serious about our mission. We funnel our energy into it, our funds into it, our lifestyle describes it. And when people look in our lives, they should see fundamental beliefs that come out of God's Word that would apply to our lives, that we're doing those things. And maybe they can't put a finger on it. They can't say, well, you know, he's doing, 1 Corinthians 13, he's really doing a good. They don't understand that, probably, but they do understand that, you know, that guy's really doing something that is admirable and pleasant to be around. And so I'm talking maybe generally about my brother, but that, you know, the fire alarm is going to go off in your life one way or another at some point, and we have to be ready for it. We need to not only have those training sessions well in mind and in our hearts and in our capabilities, we also can look and see that in other people and be there for them. I think the circumstance of the community is what impressed me the most in this situation. I've never been around a community or around a person, or maybe I've just never been close enough to a situation like this that I could see all these blessings come together for one person. And they were doing what I would expect the church to do, but this was people, just as unconverted people that you might think, well, they wouldn't do those things, but they were doing them. And I'm sure I've left a lot out because I've been gone for a couple months, and I know that things just kept happening, and I lost track at some point. But it was just a very pleasant thing to witness. They did things out of compassion and sympathy, because they respected the person and the people that were going through the suffering. They didn't have to, but they didn't have to, but they did not turn a blind eye, and they returned things that nobody knew they had. One guy calls and said, "Hey, I've got some box of tools here. He left, you know, he was going to come." It's like, really? And it's just, again, such a blessing to have customers and friends and community like that. You can be turning to, just turn to James 1:27. I want to go over a little bit more some of the principles that I came away with from this event. That nothing new. It's just when something happens, you suddenly read scriptures with a different focus. And when I read James 1:27 now, you know, this is pure and undefiled religion, right? So pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their trouble. In their trouble. What kind of trouble would an orphan or a widow have? Well, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. So what kind of trouble would an orphan or a widow have? Well, how about financial trouble, legal trouble, property trouble, equipment trouble, vehicle trouble, leaking roof trouble? There are plenty of troubles that a widow could have, and if you think about a orphan or a fatherless individual, there are a whole nother batch of things that you could imagine. Everything from feeling sorry for yourself because of the situation, to guilt, sadness, I'm not like everybody else, whatever the situation is, there are a lot of troubles that orphans and widows would have and do have. And most of the time, orphans and widows or fatherless won't tell you their problems unless you go and get to know them and develop a relationship, because they're feeling bad and they don't want to be in a spotlight. But if you look around the church, if you look at the number of widows, there are widowers also, but God seems to favor the widows. There are a lot of widows in the church, and that means there are a lot of people that need taken care of. So again, it said the pure and undefiled religion is to visit the orphans and the widows. So is that the pastor's job? Well, if the pastor had to go visit every person that had a crisis going on in their family, and it doesn't, the implication is you don't go visit one time and then that's it, you know, like have a good life. This would be a relationship. You have to go visit, and you have to, you at that point you start understanding what is going on in the life. You can see that the snow's not shoveled. You can see the grass isn't mowed. You can, you know, you start realizing and you start getting inside their life a little bit, and you see what their needs are. Now, for this to work, others have to take part in this. This is a group effort. This is a, it's not just the pastor. It's everybody is kind of taking their turn. And I don't know, is it adopt a widow or adopt a fatherless? But there are, if everybody does a little bit, it's a manageable task. If one person has to try to do it all, it's not going to work. Each person has to be a committee of one to spread the love and to help get the job done. And if you want to think of it in selfish terms, think about it as in terms of paying it forward. You know, at some point, the fire alarm is going to go off and it's going to be your problem, and you're going to be the one that's laid up or in some kind of strait that you can't get out of. And wouldn't it be nice if someone came to visit you or me? And so that is a selfish way to look at it, but it is real, and it will give all of us time to think about it when the time comes. You'll realize how important it is to turn sympathy and compassion into action. So you have to, by visiting, you can walk in their shoes, you can see and understand what's going on a lot better. So what about the phrase, the phrase at the end of that verse is kind of, it's like, what do you mean, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world? Why is that part of pure and undefiled religion? How would that apply to widows and orphans? Well, maybe because they're vulnerable people and they need good examples to look forward or to look towards. People that maybe are manifesting what good character is, or maybe a child would look and see what a good parent figure would look like. There are things and qualities that we should, as, let's say, married people or family people, we should be able to portray a godly characteristics that other people would look at and help them to make good decisions. And in the process, if you involve the widow and the orphan or the fatherless into your life and into your family, you can help them to learn accountability, and you can be teaching life lessons that they aren't necessarily going to get. It's hard for a single parent or a no parent are being around. Some of these life lessons are very hard to get across because it just doesn't, the environment is not there to produce it. Exodus 22:22. I want to just talk about, you know, normally I don't talk about widows very much, but suddenly I have a widow in my life, and I think it's worth thinking about. Exodus 22, verse 22, God says, "You shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If you afflict them in any way and they cry at all to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will become hot, and I will kill you with a sword. Your wives shall be widows." I guess if he killed you with a sword, your wife would be a widow, and your children fatherless. So God's saying that he takes it very seriously that you do not afflict a widow or a fatherless person. Psalm 68:5, we don't have to turn there. God is a father to the fatherless and a defender of widows. God takes their plight very seriously. Deuteronomy 14, Deuteronomy 14 and verse 28. Deuteronomy 14, 28 says, "At the end of every third year, you shall bring out the tithe of your produce that year and set it up within your gate." So we're talking about third tithe here. "And the Levite, because he has no portion nor inheritance with you, and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow," so here we're talking fatherless and the widow, which would obviously take in people in the orphan category, "the fatherless and the widow who are within your gates," in other words, you are aware of the situation, they're within your realm of influence that you can do something about, "that they may come and eat and be satisfied." So the whole idea of third tithe is to be able to take care of the widow and the fatherless, that they may eat and be satisfied, that the Lord may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do. So there's a connectable progression. You take care of them, and God will take care of you. And so we all want to be taken care of. So we're coming up on the Feast of Tabernacles. Turn over a couple chapters to chapter 16 and verse 13. 16 verse 13 says, "You shall observe the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days, when you have gathered from your threshing floor and from your winepress, and you shall rejoice." You shall rejoice. This shall be gladness and wonderful. "You shall rejoice in your feast, you and your son and your daughter." Sure, we want the family to be together. "Your male servant and your female servant and the Levite, the stranger and the fatherless and widow who are within your gates." Again, if they're at your feast site or if they're in your church, that they're in your realm of influence, all are to rejoice and enjoy the feast. You're not supposed to have subsistence living, that a person, you know, here's this widow and a child living in the car trying to figure out where to get ready for church or something. So we need to remember this at the Feast of Tabernacles as we go to the Feast of Tabernacles, but it's not just at the feast, they have to get to the feast. So these things have to be thought of and acted on, many cases before it's time to go to the feast, to make sure that they can be happy and satisfied and are living abundantly so they can get to the feast. And it applies on the holy days and on the Sabbath. We have to remember to incorporate the less fortunate into our daily activities, even on the Sabbath day. If we're having a picnic, then we invite people who might not normally have picnics. It's just, we go outside, and we have to look around and make it a point to make sure that the fatherless and the widows are able to rejoice. Sending money is helpful, but it's more meaningful, it's more helpful if we go and we do something, if we assist, if we, you know, sending a widow $1,000 might get her gutters cleaned, but it might not, because she might not know how to hire the right person that would do it correctly, and it could be more trouble than it's worth. But it's very effective if somebody just goes and does it, and then they don't have to maybe hand out the money, but the thing that was really needed can be done and is taken care of. It's extremely beneficial. You know, we don't have to go to Acts 6, but you can go there later and think about it. Acts 6 is where the widows were being neglected on a daily basis, and so this was the church was aware of it, and they took action, and they ended up ordaining what we would call deacons to take care of this. But you don't have to be ordained to go do good for a widow or a fatherless person. So we can each be a committee of one to do and look around and see what needs to be done. So they came up with a plan, and they said, let's ordain these people to take care of these things. And they chose good people, men that were full of the Spirit, and the idea is that the widow needs taken care of, not put in a compromised position of something. You know, Matthew 24, verse 12 talks about, says, "And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold." And I think it's very easy to see that in our world today, where it's such a materialistic me generation, we get wrapped up in our own cares, we're all busy, we're all doing our own thing, and we can very easily overlook people that are needy. We've received so many cards personally, and I know that my sister-in-law has received a lot of cards also. And cards are a great way of communicating to people. And I think if you think this through, I think you'll agree with me that a card is great, but especially if you're not there, I mean, you're not going to, in Kennewick, you're not going to go to Oklahoma City or Watonga, Oklahoma, and work on a work party. That's not realistic or practical. And you might send a card, and that's great. But it's, again, much more effective if you go visit the widow or the fatherless, and or if you go mow the grass, or if you do something or invite them over, if you have personal interaction with them, you're much better off, and they're much better off. So much better to do something rather than just having a warm place in your heart for these people because, you know, oh, I'm really sorry this person has this problem. That doesn't fix anything. Doing something for them would actually fix something. And the other part of it is that genuine love is expressed in many different ways. And, you know, one person is going to knit a blanket or do some kind of a knick-knack. Another one's going to get the hammer and saw out. Another one might go shopping with somebody or go to lunch. So there are many. You have to develop your own system of assisting and taking care of the widow and the fatherless. It's not a one-size-fits-all. And then it's ongoing care. Again, the card feels good because you send the card and it's like, well, I've done my job. And yet the firewood still needs cut and the grass still needs mowed and the snow still needs shoveled. And so, again, it takes an ongoing relationship for these people. And you say, well, I'm not all that capable. It's like, well, you know, it doesn't take that much to check on her furnace filter or to take the child along with your family event. You're going to the park or the mountain or the trail or whatever, and to take someone else with you. Again, go ahead and pay it forward. If you take care of them, God's going to take care of you. 1 Corinthians 16:13. I skipped the love chapter. You have to read that on your own time. 1 Corinthians 16:13 says, watch, stand fast in the faith, be brave, be strong. And that's true. Sometimes it does take bravery and strength. And verse 14, let all that you do be done with love. It's not everything that we, you know, are emotional about. It's do what you do, let it be done with love. If you're going to, you know, okay, so all you can do is pray, then you're going to pray. You're going to do that in a sincere and brave and strong manner, and you're going to think through and break your prayers down fine and let God know that you're concerned, because sometimes that is all you can do, and that's okay. Well, what does that person really need? Sometimes that's hard to get to. It's hard to break it down and to understand. Some people are very closed. They may even resist the visit. They may not welcome you with open arms. They may not want to come over to your house. So you're going to have to use wisdom with each one of the situations. Again, the parable of the Good Samaritan, the one who did something, that took action, that didn't escape the, you know, didn't go to the other side of the road. Christ was pleased and praised with the one that did something, not the one that felt sympathy or that looked and turned his head the other way. John 13:34. John 13, verse 34. Christ said, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this, all will know that you are my disciples if you have love one for another." And from my perspective, there is love in the church. And there is love for the brethren. Are we perfect? Do we have too many little spats and too much drama? Sometimes, but, you know, are we perfect? Could we do better? Okay, we need to, yeah, we can always do better. We can always do better, but it's a process. It's a walk. We have to continue doing the best we can. And tonight, if we had a bad day, we're going to go to bed, get a good night's sleep, get up tomorrow, and start over again with a good attitude and renewed enthusiasm and go at it again. And we're going to do the best we can every day with God's help. That's what he would expect of us, and that's what we should be doing. But he said, just as I have loved you. And if you think about Christ, yes, he gave his life, but he was also a part of the solution in his life. He healed the sick. He fed people. He encouraged people. He was a part of the solution. He was a friend. He was doing many things in his life as a living person that we also can do. And yes, he knew what was best for them, and yes, he had incredible wisdom. But the answer is he contributed to society in his life and in through his death. Philippians 2 and verse 1. Philippians 2 and verse 1. Says, if there is any consolation in Christ, if any comfort of love, if any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and mercy, fulfill my joy being like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit. So if you're going to go help the widow or the fatherless, you're not going to do it to be able to take home a placard that says, I did my thing for the day. But in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look not only for his own interest, but also for the interest of others. And so again, you're going to have to look. You're going to look for the interest of others, and you're going to have to think about it. It's, you know, the Deuteronomy 15:7, we're not going to go there, but it says, you shall not harden your heart nor shut up your hand. You know, God doesn't want to see the closed fist. He wants to see the open. He wants to see you lending to, you giving, you providing, you helping each other, not closing up and turning away. So based on the experience that I've been through and that our family is going through, I praise those who have reached out to our family. God's people are very generous, but there are many other people that have gone through and are going through sorrowful times, locally and far away. And as news travels, and we're still getting people that, you know, back east or wherever, and they find out what happened, and they're very sympathetic and saddened. And so it's interesting how somebody, we are not isolated. This is a big world, and we're very connected, and people do care about one another, even if they haven't seen you in years. It's very heartbreaking when they find out what's happened. But our family is not special. We don't need some kind of a bonus effort, because when we're going through our little event, there are serious, senseless killings going on all over this country and around the world, and these people do not have hope in most cases. They do not understand. There's so much anger that it's heartbreaking to watch it, and to be a part of the family that maybe would be the perpetrator or even in the victims of all this senseless killing. But that wasn't the case. This event affected our family, and it was different because it was my brother, and something like that had never happened before. So it was difficult, but I have hope, and I know that he's going to be resurrected, and I know that based on what I've seen, that his life was lived honorably, and other people in these senseless killings are not able to have the same hope. It's not the same. And we do learn through all these experiences, and we watch as others go through the trials. But it's been a blessing for me to be, I'll say, close up and personal with this one, because that doesn't happen, and it gives me encouragement that all is not lost in America. There are a lot of good people in this country, a lot of good pockets where they are trying to live Christian ways, and they're doing their best with what they have, and that is honorable. I appreciate that. God allows things to happen. It isn't for me to question God's motives. It is for me to take it and keep going, keep walking, and not give up on life or give up on God. The dead will come back to life, and the dead will surely want to hear the stories about what happened after they were gone. I hope to be there when my brother comes back to life, and we can tell him what a fine group of customers he had, and how much they appreciated him, and how much the community thought of him, and how his wife and daughter went on to do great things. It's going to be a wonderful time when we get together and the families are reunited, and we have God to thank for that. So, what a blessing it is to know that God's going to wipe away every tear, and that there is going to be no more death, and there's not going to be any more sorrow one of these days, and there's not going to be any more crying, and there won't be any more pain, because those will be things of the old world. It's going to be a new world, and God is going to be in charge of it. But in this world, we have the ability to turn our compassion into action.